The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, we'll learn how an introduced fish population in the Adirondacks has evolved to avoid capture. New research has revealed neurons tied to binge drinking. And we'll spend time with historians working to bring back a centuries-old barn in the Berkshires. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Smallmouth bass are prized by anglers, but when introduced to waters outside of their natural range, can outcompete native species. Despite years of eradication efforts in the Adirondacks, researchers at Cornell University find smallmouth bass populations have not decreased significantly and have, in fact, evolved. To learn more, I spoke with evolutionary biologist Dr. Liam Zari, a Smithsonian postdoctoral fellow at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C.
Among anglers, smallmouth are widely recognized as being this amazing sport fish. They fight really hard. They're an amazing fish to fish for. They're really fun. But they also have sort of this infamous ecological background, which is they are spreading north right now. They're native to North America, but they're spreading north as a result of our warming climate. But they've also been introduced to a lot of waters as sport fish because they're so desired by anglers to fish for. They're pound for pound one of the hardest fighting fish out there. And the work that we did is set up in the Adirondacks, which they're not native to, but they're introduced all across those waters in the 1800s and 1900s for anglers, essentially, to come in and fish for. But when smallmouth are introduced to a water body that's new to them, they very commonly, after a couple of generations, they can completely take over the lake or stream ecosystem because they're these voracious predators, and they just chow through most of the native food web.
What are some of the native species that smallmouth bass are consuming in upstate New York and the Adirondacks that has become a problem?
Sure. Yeah. So a lot of the native minnows, for example, that form the base of the food web for other predatory fishes like brook trout once they get larger and lake trout once they get larger, all of these fish are feeding on our native minnow assemblage, of which we have many, many minnows in upstate New York and the Adirondacks. But smallmouth also are voracious feeders on crayfish as well. In the lakes that we work on, we see that they're not only eating the native minnow population, but they also eat a lot of crayfish as well. So for all the anglers out there, crayfish lures, if you're not already onto them, those bottom jigs are great for catching smallies.
So there's been efforts for years to eliminate problem fish like smallmouth bass in the Adirondacks. And not only are they, you know, popular with sportsmen and anglers, like you had mentioned, but they're also seen as a nuisance. Your study actually looked at how smallmouth bass have changed over time in response to efforts to remove them from waters where they are a danger to native species. Now, how exactly did smallmouth bass populations change over time, and how did your team go about discovering that?
Sure, yeah. So in the lakes that we were working on in the Adirondacks, this was a suppression effort that was started in the years 2000 and 2003 by the principal investigator of our lab at the time, Dr. Cliff Kraft. And there are a couple different methods to remove invasive fishes. There's sort of the nuclear option, which is a chemical application called rotenone. But for a lot of water bodies, that's not really an option because there are these native species that chemical kills everything in the lake. If you can treat the entire water body, which is difficult to do in lakes that are really deep, for example, or have really extensive wetlands. So another option that's a more targeted approach is called electrophishing, which is essentially introducing electricity to the water, whether that's from a backpack carried battery unit or whether that's a generator on a boat. And the lab that I was working in went for that latter option, the generator on a boat. And essentially, the way the removal works is moving along the edges of the lake, shocking the water, and we stun all the fishes in the vicinity. We scoop them up, and the invasive smallmouth bass go in the cooler, and all the native fishes were able to get some basic information about those, such as their lengths, and those then go back over the side. So it's a way to do a targeted species removal.
Over the course 22 to 25 years, over the last couple of decades, what were some of the changes that your team noticed in the bass themselves?
Sure. Well, so this work, I started my PhD at Cornell in 2018. So I was working with these data and samples that Cliff Kraft and then his successor, Dr. Pete McIntyre, decided to keep and archive. And this work really wouldn't have been possible without the preservation of that data and those samples. But the surprising life history phenomenon that they documented was in the first few years of this really intensive eradication effort. I mean, removing thousands and thousands of fish from this lake every year. In the first year or two, it looked like populations were starting to decrease, but then they exploded, which was completely counter to, of course, what they wanted. They wanted to eradicate the smallmouth bass from this lake, but they were able to get rid of a lot of the large old individuals. But then what they found is that every single year there was this huge bumper crop of small young of year bass that had just been born in that year. And that's extremely odd for smallmouth bass populations. Normally bass have a good recruitment year, which is survival of the babies to their first year. That only happens every once in a while, every 3, 4, 5 years. But what they're observing is every single year was a great year for these small juvenile bass. And really there are a couple things going on. It's just complicated because you are completely changing the food web in this ecosystem. And so what we think is going on is that all these bass were getting removed. We would remove as about 25% of the population every year, we estimate. But for all the bass that are left, this is a great lake to be a smallmouth bass because there's far less competition for their food resources. And so those young of year bass, they could grow much more during their first year. And they could make it through that first winter. And the first winter is really the major first major mortality event once the bass have left their dad's nest. And so there was sort of this initial what we call a demographic effect where our removal removed a lot of individuals, but left all of these, for all the bass that were left, they could do really well. And then through time, what we documented is that the bass who were steadily investing more and more and more into early maturation. So the bass on the ones who were the earliest to mature, which is ages 3 and 4 for males and females respectively, they're investing more and more and more into early reproduction. And so what we did is we examined their genome between the years 2000 and 2019, and we found that this early reproductive investment, this rapid growth rate, is actually an evolutionary change. So before the removal got going, there was likely a mix of life history strategies, all the way from live fast, die young, to grow slowly and reproduce when you're older. And what we think we've done with our removal, and by essentially doubling the annual mortality of this population every year, is we just selected for and allowed that live fast, die young life history strategy to take over the lake. And in doing so, this population has evolved and is thus becoming more and more resilient to our removal efforts every year that passes by.
So the fish have actually shrunk over time. Is that what you're saying? That the ones that have survived, that are the smaller fish and that are able to reproduce when they're younger animals and that don't grow to a larger size, those are the ones that are taking over the small bass populations and these lakes. So these are kind of like incredible shrinking fish over time. Is that a good way of describing it?
Yeah, it's interesting because if you just look at the population itself without taking into account the age structure of the lake, it would look like, yes, this population of bass, every individual is now smaller. But what it that's underlain essentially by it's a younger population of bass. The individuals that we see now are actually, and this is somewhat counterintuitive, but age one smallmouth bass, for example, they're growing faster than age one smallmouth bass did before the removal got underway. Same with age two, age three, age four. So our individuals are actually growing faster, and that's an evolutionarily mediated trait. We found that there's been a genomic change that actually underlies those rapid growth rates. And why we think that is because smallmouth bass, like many other fish, need to hit a certain size in order to reproduce. And so what we think is going on is that we've just grabbed a subset of the population that grow really quickly to get to this threshold size to mature as young as possible, because they're probably not going to make it to the next year.
So what does this research tell you about how one, an invasive species can be managed, but also to how native animals can be protected under the threat of invasive species like in the Adirondack smallmouth bass?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the best way to manage invasive species, and we've learned this time and time again in all sorts of different ecosystems and with all sorts of different species, the best way to deal with invasive species is just not let them in the first place, because once they're in and once they're established, it is so hard to get rid of them. And in other contexts, there's been sort of more broadly for managing invasive species an evolutionary adaptation to the measures we take to eradicate them. That's been documented in response to things like herbicides, trying to get rid of invasive weeds. Those weeds can evolve a physiological resistance to those herbicides. Or in terms of pesticides, you can think of insects that plague our agricultural systems, and they can also evolve a physiological resistance to the pesticides that we apply. What we've found is that even in the absence of kind of a clear physiological pathway, invasive species can evolve or can undergo life history evolution. So the main driver we think that is pushing this evolutionary pressure along is just the doubling of annual mortality. And that alone can push populations to mature, do whatever they have to do to mature earlier. And there are a whole other, now that we've sort of, you know, sorted out this life history evolution, there are all sorts of other follow-ups that we want to do to see, you know, is there behavioral evolution? Are they eating differently than their ancestors did? But that's all work that we're hoping to look at in the next coming years.
Dr. Liam Zari is a Smithsonian postdoc at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., and a former researcher at Cornell University. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Using mice, researchers at the University of Massachusetts Chan Medical School in Worcester have identified neurons tied to binge drinking. We learn more now from WAMC's James Polyoligopoulos.
Researchers in Massachusetts say they've found a neurological needle in the haystack, an ensemble of neurons that could mean the difference between stopping after a drink or two or going overboard in binge drinking. The NIH-funded research focused on mice, but with follow-up, the discovery could have major implications for treating humans with alcohol addiction. Dr. Gilles Martin tells WAMC he's long been interested in exactly what the brain does in response to alcohol consumption. An associate professor of neurobiology at the UMass Chan Medical School in Worcester, he says compared to other things we ingest or inject to feel pleasure, booze doesn't activate the brain's reward center the way a good meal or certain drugs might. In fact, as a paper that caught his eye 30 years ago found, alcohol doesn't seem to activate all that many parts of the brain to begin with.
This paper showed that when you give alcohol to a mouse or a rat, only very few cells are actually activated by alcohol. If you take, for instance, the nucleus accumbens, the accumbens is what probably everybody understands to be or knows to be the reward center of the brain. You know, when you do something very pleasurable, when you take a drug, you should not. Or when you eat really something absolutely delicious, well, this is the part of the brain that will say, well, this is really good. I should really get more of it. And this region has been known as the reward center for 40 years. And this paper, when it came out and it showed that only very, very few cells in neurons in these brain regions were actually activated by alcohol, I was very intrigued.
Years later, he and a team of UMass Chan staff and others wrapped up their own project, also using mice. In the process, they discovered a series of neurons that appear to have a sizable effect on how much drinking a mouse might do before calling it quits. For context, the human brain is home to billions upon billions of neurons. A mouse, meanwhile, is more in the realm of 70 million, some estimate. Martin, lead author of the paper published in Nature Neuroscience, says his team was able to use an array of technologies to narrow down parts of the brain activated by alcohol, only a few hundred neurons that seem to act as a proverbial brake, preventing excessive alcohol consumption.
What we found is that there is a region in the prefrontal cortex that is called the medial orbitofrontal cortex, where there is really a few cells that are really activated. And again, it's really a back of the envelope calculation, but my estimate is about 500 cells based on the density of neurons in this brain region and the number of cells that are, you know, turned on by alcohol. So we found this cluster of 500 cells that we call neuronal ensemble that is activated by alcohol. And when they are activated by alcohol, actually they reduce alcohol consumption. If we ablate the cells or if we turn them off using a technique that is called optogenetics, so we use a combination of light and, well, we use light to turn them off. When we do that, the alcohol consumption really goes up, and for weeks.
Using the aforementioned techniques, the researchers' setup allowed them to see what kind of excess the rodents indulge in when the switch is flipped off and a sort of almost temperance when it's on.
Where we saw a big difference is whether when we turned off these neurons, the mice were really drinking much, much more. They were really going, you know, the way our little setup, it's very simple. It's a bottle that contains 20% alcohol, and there is a spout, and the animal is really completely free to drink or not to drink. There is really absolutely no constraints, I mean, nothing. And when we turn off these neurons, you can see the mice really go to the spout much more often, and they really drink much more. And when we do the opposite, when we excite these neurons, well, all of a sudden, the mice don't seem to really to care that much about the alcohol. So we can really manipulate the behavior of the mouse either by exciting or inhibiting these cells.
It's a discovery that, if pursued and studied further, could have major implications in the world of treating alcohol abuse, leading to improved therapeutics. Martin tells WAMC that in terms of medications currently on the market, there aren't too many stellar options for those dealing with alcohol addiction. A number of drugs tend to target neuroreceptors across the brain and often pack side effects so potent those in need might be discouraged from taking them. To be able to pinpoint parts of the brain where alcohol does its thing could lead to better targeted treatments for one of the world's leading causes of death. Binge drinking in the United States is said to affect over 16 million people ages 12 and up, he said in an article he authored.
This is the interesting part. It's really somewhat counterintuitive because when alcohol is on board, these neurons are activated to reduce alcohol consumption. And this is where I think the paper is really getting some attention, because typically when you take a drug of abuse, you know, you take cocaine or heroin, it will have reinforcing properties, meaning that you say, oh my God, this is really good, I'm going to take some more. And this is, to my knowledge, the first time that someone is showing that a drug of abuse like alcohol actually, well, it's certainly also doing that, but is also activating this cluster of neurons that will counteract its reinforcing properties. So this is really something really, really cool.
Martin emphasizes that while mice brains and human brains share similarities, making rodents great for neuroscience research, that doesn't necessarily mean human brains have the same setup for dealing with binge drinking. There's follow-up research to be done, he says. In a write-up on the UMass Chan website, he ventures to say the number of core neurons that affect binge drinking could also be even smaller. He hopes to see further research funded, though he adds that, among his colleagues and beyond, there's ongoing concern over where that money might come from. For example, Martin's team was the recipient of what's known as an R1 grant from the National Institutes of Health, which has been implementing large-scale cuts over the past few months. Federal authorities have cited a need to scale back and cut spending considered to be wasteful. It's meant significant cutbacks for universities like UMass Chan, which received $193 million from the NIH last year and now faces a $35 million shortfall, it reported in April. Layoffs, furloughs, and freezes have followed. Martin says that changes at the NIH are having a ripple effect across the research community, with aftershocks to be felt for years to come, especially if more cuts are on the horizon.
The impact would be long-term, certainly, because if this budget is voted, it's very likely that some labs will certainly shut down. And even more worrisome is the fact that a new generation of scientists is going to look, you know, elsewhere. Because, you know, when you want to grad school now, and, well, the number of labs where you're going to do your work is going to be limited. And frankly, you know, this is not exactly the environment where you want to, to commit to for the next, you know, 5 to 6 years of your life, not knowing what will be, you know, the options at the end of your PhD.
Reporting from Springfield, this is James Polyoligopoulos at WAMC's Pioneer Valley News Bureau on the campus of Western New England University.
This is the best of our knowledge. We now travel to a rural corner of Western Massachusetts where efforts are underway to dismantle and relocate a 200-year-old structure. WAMC's Josh Landes reports.
Atop the bare frame of a weather-beaten old barn, next to a herd of indifferent Highland cattle, Renard Thompson and Dylan Wideman of Bring Back Barns are hand-operating a winch to lower a massive beam to the earth.
It's very romantic, it's very dirty, it's all creative problem-solving. So it's really kind of makeshift engineering where, especially when you're taking timbers down or you're repairing them in place, you have to figure out how to keep it all standing while you're taking major structural members out.
Wideman.
You know, often we'll be opening up a joint or a mortise and it hasn't seen the light of day in 250 years. And you see the work that the old carpenters did. And they make some of the same mistakes that we do sometimes.
As far as anyone can tell, this barn dates back to 1815.
And we know that from the nail types.
Bring Back Barns owner and operator Thompson, a devotee of traditional barn crafting techniques.
There are four types of nails, rather, that were commonly used in this country. And the first was hand wrought by a blacksmith, pounding into a swage on top of an anvil, red hot iron. And then around 1790 plus, they invented nail making machines, which they took a sheet of iron and chopped out the nails from that, and they put a head on them. And so that was the first type of nail was only used until about 1815. Then they got a much superior type of cut nail. And this barn is all built with those cut nails.
Since the 1990s, this particular barn has been in the hands of the Nature Conservancy. Land steward Renee Wendell oversees more than 8,400 acres of Nature Conservancy holdings in western Massachusetts.
Where the candy barn is located, it's right in our Schnaab Brook Preserve, which is close to 3,000 acres. Ecologically speaking, it's probably the most diverse place in all of Massachusetts.
Over the centuries, the candy barn has been used for agriculture and cider making, survived a prior move to its present location at the southern fringe of Berkshire County in the 80s, and was serving as a repository for a pool cleaning business when the Nature Conservancy took it over in the 90s. Its new owner says it wasn't love at first sight.
Well, if anybody looked at it now, it is a disaster. I mean, it is just a mess. The holes, all the sides are falling down. And when I got here, the first time I sought it out and found it, it looked horrible.
Sally Harris, along with her husband Fred, is answering the Nature Conservancy's call for someone to take over the decrepit barn. With conservation restrictions on the current property, that means moving the structure to a new location.
And so I was almost like, well, forget that. The only way to get in was to go up on a ladder to crawl in.
Thompson and his Bring Back Barns crew are delicately dismantling the hand-hewn barn to move it to the Harris's property in Egremont, just up the road.
We're bringing it back to that life. We're going to put a wood floor in the entire thing. And when you look up about 12 feet up, you'll see these big, beautiful timbers. And then the rafters forming a kind of a cathedral-like sense.
The Harrises previously restored the stone church St. James Place in Great Barrington, which reopened as a community space in 2017.
It's a beautiful church. It was built in 1857 in the parish house in 1910, and it was going to turn into a parking lot on Main Street. So my husband and I created a 501c3 nonprofit to restore the building and to repurpose it as a community asset.
Harris says taking charge of forgotten gems like the candy barn is a privilege. Past its present ramshackle exterior, she says she can see its new future.
These are treasures. You just don't want to tear them down in the middle of the night. I mean, this it's hard to look at this one and call it a treasure. You have to look inside.
Reporting from the WAMC News, Berkshire Bureau at the Beacon Cinema, I'm Josh Landis.
This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1814. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.